Hello, everybody. This is Jim, your host of the Bible Study Podcast. I am back again. Today we are going to get into episode 44, Scientific Evidence for God. This episode is essentially born from a recent effort that I did in a city near me in Oberlin, Ohio. I felt like the Lord was tugging on my heart to go down and do some evangelism. I have done a lot of research over the years since becoming a Christian in apologetics, whether it's scientific evidence for God, philosophical evidence for God, historical evidence for God, and even comparing different religions and the truth claims they make and how Christianity stacks up against them. So what I had decided to do was, like I said, felt like the Lord was pulling on my heart to go into a city near me, downtown Oberlin. It's a very liberal city. It's a city of a pretty well-known university, Oberlin College. People from all over the world come to study there, to study the fine arts. So it's a liberal arts focused university. So it's a college town with about a lot of young people that come in and out during the semester, start and end. So I feel like it was a great place to go and share Christ. The city was founded, or not founded, but was reached early in its days by a Christian missionary named Charles Finney. And he ended up planting the first church in Oberlin, which today is called the First Church of Oberlin. And since then, unfortunately, that church has tended to lean away from biblical teaching on several subjects. So the town, like I said, has over the years has grown very liberal and secular in its makeup. And that's where my church has planted a campus and where we've got a heart for, so that's our mission field. So over the last few weeks, I've been going in their downtown square where people tend to walk around and hang out, and I just set up a microphone and a speaker and got some notes together and started sharing on different topics for proof of God. So the first week was scientific evidence for God, and I felt like, you know what, this is probably really good stuff to be able to turn around and share on our podcast. So if you've ever questioned what science has said related to your faith and how much they coincide or disagree, then I think this is going to be a good episode for you. This is not an extensive list of scientific evidences for God. There are more. But these are the notes that I prepared for my first week out in Oberlin, and I'm actually getting ready to create a YouTube channel. So when that's up and going, I will follow up with you guys on that. But yeah, today we're gonna go scientific evidence for God. As I believe I've mentioned before, I used to be an atheist, and when I was an atheist, I thought that Christians were sexist and dumb and gullible, intellectually lazy, and worst of all, that they were willing to believe a comforting lie rather than embrace truth. And what I didn't understand at that time is that all of these things could be true about Christians and yet still have no bearing on Christianity and the truth claims that it makes. Just because there are bad examples out there doesn't necessarily logically follow that Christianity is false. So almost 10 years ago, like I said, I was an atheist, and I took comfort in science reinforcing what I believed about God. But as I started to really look into what that science said, and what confirmed science said, I should say, and separating that from the assumptions that are often made about, or inferences, I should say, that are often made in response to scientific findings or discoveries or claims, and I separated those two out, what I discovered ended up changing my life. For example, most people are roughly familiar with the Big Bang Theory, right? So the Big Bang Theory says that in the beginning of the universe, everything existed in this super tiny, super condensed molecule where all of the universe and all the matter and energy inside it were contained. And then at one point, that molecule bangs or expands outward into what is the known universe, okay? So You know, we take this theory and we work with it from there. We could start from the fact that science does not believe that things come out of nothing. So where did that initial molecule, super dense, primordial atom, whatever, where did that come from in the first place? Because science does not believe, science cannot prove or repeat or observe anything ever coming out of nothing. There is always a source for something. There is always an explanation for why something gets into a place. So in order to believe, first of all, in the Big Bang Theory, you need to first believe that, and separate that from belief in God, you need to believe that things pop out of nothing, which is not observable, it's not repeatable, it's not testable, it completely defies scientific theory. So that's why we don't walk around, you know, in fear that an elephant's going to suddenly appear above our head and drop on us and kill us, or that while you're at work you don't fear that when you come home that there's going to be a lion that suddenly appeared in your living room and is going to attack you when you get there, because we don't believe that things appear out of nothing. So if we don't believe that, on what could seem like a silly example, right? If we don't believe that, then why would we believe that the entire universe, which is far more complex than a lion or an elephant or whatever, far more complex than those things, because the sum of those things plus way more, why do we believe that the universe would appear out of nothing? So to me that's a problem. But so, sorry, just following my notes here. So I guess you could say, as far as the, you know, things appearing out of nothing, that if that were to be the case, if something did somehow appear out of nothing, even though we've never ever observed that in the history of humankind and scientific thought and theory, if we did observe that, if we did believe that, that would be nothing short than a miracle. And the last time I checked, I don't think that atheists or naturalists, people who just believe in the real world around them, that what you can touch, see, and feel with your five senses, I don't think that they believe in miracles. So they're in need of one if they are to believe that everything got here without God. The next question to ask is, why did that primordial atom, right, that first molecule, whatever you want to call it, that infinitely dense universe before it expanded into what we know today, why did it bang or expand in the first place? Isaac Newton, when he wrote the Law of Motion, said that an object at rest remains at rest, and an object in motion remains in motion at constant speed and in a straight line unless acted on by an unbalanced or outside force. Whenever one object exerts a force on another object, the second object exerts an equal and opposite force on the first. So that's the Law of Motion that Isaac Newton wrote, right? Pretty important for science. According to the Law of Motion, it's not even possible for the universe to have expanded in the first place without some external force or God to act on it. Again, look at it. An object at rest remains at rest, and an object in motion remains in motion at constant speed and in a straight line unless acted on by an unbalanced, or we might say today, an outside force. So in order for the universe to expand in the first place, you need something outside of the universe to act on it. Okay. And I imagine somebody might say, but why do we need God in this equation? In time, we may discover some scientific reason or cause of the universe without invoking God. And to that, there's two things. Number one, you still haven't answered for how everything got there in the first place out of nothing, which again is scientifically problematic. And number two, you're proposing, honestly, that science weigh in an area that it cannot, okay? Science is not meant to deal in the abstract. It's not meant to deal in theory. It's not meant to deal in religion. So when people say that science and religion don't mix in one way, yeah, sure, you're right. They're, you know, science has no religious opinion. I would agree there. But it also does not have any opinion opposing. So again, you know, when you suggest, oh, science can explain how we got here, no, It cannot, it will not, it never will. Because what you're dealing with is not a scientific problem. It's not a problem, it's not a question science can answer. You're dealing with a logical problem, right? You're dealing with theory, you're dealing with metaphysics, you're dealing with philosophy, okay? Logically, scientifically, reasonably, you cannot explain the existence of everything without a godlike supreme being being present in the equation. You're just not going to get there. If you ever heard the expression, you can't get there from here, right? You may be driving out somewhere on a road trip, get lost, you turn over and you ask a local, hey, trying to look for, you know, this city or this place, this destination. And if you're very unfortunate, then that person may say, oh, you can't get there from here. In other words, you got to go back the way you came. You got to start over, right? So if the atheist or the naturalist wants to believe that the universe got here out of nothing, caused out of nothing and then expanded without some external force, you know, imposing itself or acting on it, then you're in a mental place. You're in a logical reason place of you can't get there from here, right? You've got to go back and you got to rework your ideas and your theories a little bit, and then come back again with some different information or a different conclusion, because you can't get to where we are today out of nothing without God. You've got to have a being that we would describe as God, some powerful, knowable, timeless, spaceless, personal being that would be the creator. And sorry if you are hearing babies crying. I'm in my office trying to stay isolated here, but my kids just woke up from a nap, so I apologize for if you're hearing any of that come through. So we move on from scientific theory from that perspective, and we look at the conditions that are necessary for life to exist on Earth. And as we go through this, we'll expand that to be life to be possible in the solar system and in our galaxy and then eventually in our universe. Okay, we'll expand outward. But for life to be possible on Earth, you need to have the Earth at the right distance from the sun. Okay, as we're looking for life on other planets, you know, which we are, you know, actively doing, we're hopeful that we will find some kind of alien life, which, and let me point out, before I get into this, it's not a problem if we find life on other planets at any level, whether it's microscopic, animal, plant, or sentient alien life like us. It's not a problem on Christianity if that were to happen. I would just guarantee you is that if there is sentient life elsewhere in the universe, that they likely have a Jesus-type figure in their history that came to them and spoke to them. I tend to think that the possibility for life to be possible elsewhere in the universe to be very, 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 very small, and I will get into that here momentarily. I don't think that there is other alien life elsewhere, and probably not even microscopic life, but I just want to say, for the person who is thinking through this, you should not be at all troubled by the possibility of it. The Bible can still be true. The Word can still be what it is. Jesus can still be Lord. And there be, you know, some type of extraterrestrial life somewhere in the universe. So don't let that shake your faith. It has no bearing on the gospel. And as we get into other subjects, you will see that there is immense evidence for the Christian faith, and that regardless of any one of these pieces being different or strange or whatever, that we don't believe in Jesus based on any one of these things. We believe on the collection of them and the truth claims of the gospel. So I guess as my encouragement to you, as from one believer to another, don't let people rock your faith over things that don't need to matter. Okay, we're talking about, in many cases, open-handed issues that we do not need to hold tight on and say that, hey, this is a necessary thing to believe. You know, like a good example of that, if we step away from science for a second, we'll get back in a moment, so I apologize for the detour, but step away from science, and you have some Christians who believe that once you're saved, you're always saved. And you have other Christians that believe that you, once you're saved, you need to make sure that you walk in obedience to Christ because you can lose your salvation. And there's different theories about how that happens. But bottom line is that there's some Christians that believe that you can't lose your salvation and others that believe you do. And I know some Christians on both sides that will accuse those other type of Christians of not actually being Christians because they don't believe that you know, one or the other. And that is what we would call an open-handed issue, okay? I can be a firmly entrenched, born-again believer that believes that you can never lose your salvation. And likewise, I can be a firmly entrenched, born-again believer that believes that you can lose your salvation. Both people can firmly believe in the Lord, and one of them be wrong on this. It's fine. You know, it matters where your faith is placed. You know, who does your heart belong to? Not about what fact of information you believe, okay? Now, some of these facts, if they're wrong, if you have enough wrong facts in your mind, yeah, they can affect the way that you live and walk out your life in Christ. And that's how I would essentially boil down some of these things. You know, how are you living in Christ? Are you walking in obedience to the Lord? Are you walking in faith? Are you trusting Him? You know, are you serving Him? Are you trying to reach the lost? Those are the questions that you should be answering to determine whether someone's a Christian or not. And like I said, you know, that's a good example of a non-scientific based fact or position or argument where Christians can both be Christians and not believe the same thing on something. And likewise, I'll say here, you know, whether you believe that alien life could exist or does exist outside of Earth, I should say, if life exists outside of Earth, it doesn't matter whether you believe that that's possible or not. I don't believe it's very possible. I don't believe it's very likely, but it doesn't affect my faith if alien life does exist or if it doesn't. It's an open-handed issue. Jesus is still God. He's still true. Right, you know, it's like the series of claims I'll say are like this. God still exists. His name is Jesus, and what He said is true. You know, and that's the case regardless of whether life exists elsewhere. Any one of these things ends up being false. I don't think that they are, which is why I'm sharing it. Would not intentionally share false information, but I digress. So, conditions for life on Earth. Right, we talk about the distance of the Earth from the Sun. If it's too close, it's too hot. Right, you can't sustain life like we have. If it's too far away, then it's too cold. Again, you can't sustain life. The type of sun, the sun that the Earth orbits around, is a star, just like many stars in the galaxy. There's billions upon billions of them in the universe, and there are different types. You know, just like there's different types of cars, different types of houses and boats and trains, there's different types of suns, okay? Some of them are far bigger than the others. Some of them give off different radiation. They're different colors, right? They're different ages. And so our star is called a yellow dwarf, okay? And it gives off a specific type of radiation, which is conducive to life, okay? And there are plenty of other suns out there that do not give off that same type of radiation. In fact, the radiation that they would give off would be toxic to life as we know it. So you need the right type of sun. Again, the size of the sun matters. If the sun were so much bigger, doesn't matter if we're still in that quote-unquote habitable zone. If it were so much bigger, that affects whether it's life, whether that planet that's orbiting around it is life-permitting or not. So essentially, the reason I say that is because that habitable zone ends up getting smaller and smaller and smaller until it's non-existent. You have a sun that's too big, you have gravity too strong, it's not conducive for life. So that's an issue, right? Type of radiation, type of the color of the sun, the size of it, okay? The size of the Earth. You know, it's not just the size of the you know, of the sun, right? The size of the earth. Our earth is a size that is conducive to it being life permitting. If it was too big, again, you know, I mentioned gravity related to the sun. Well, gravity related to the planet that we'd be on would be too heavy and life would not be able to exist. There is only, now we are not as big as we could be. You know, we could be a little bit, or I think a couple of times bigger than we are, but not much bigger. Because again, life would not be able to metabolize and exist, you know, if we were a lot bigger. Likewise, if it's too small, then you don't have enough gravity to be able to hold in an atmosphere, and to be able to hold on to things on your planet. So that's a factor. The placement of our solar system within our galaxy, that's another piece. Not many people think about that. So if you look at our galaxy, our galaxy is in the shape of a spiral, okay? If you Google the Milky Way galaxy, and if you can see the shape of it, what you'll see is, if you're looking down on it, you'll see a circular shaped image with a bright spot in the center, right, where our black hole is. And where a lot of stars are. That's why it's bright and not black, because there's a whole bunch of stars. Gravity there is very, very strong. And you'll see a whole lot of arms just kind of spiraling off, almost looking like, some kind of a wind toy or something like that. You got these kids' toys that are on these little plastic propellers, right? And they've got these arms, and they're meant to catch wind. It's kind of similar shape to that. It's just these little spiral arms that come out from the center, and they start fat and they get skinnier and skinnier until they, you know, dissipate at the tips. Well, we're kind of near the end of one of those tips, not at the very end, but we're kind of near the end. It's a fairly quiet spot in the galaxy, and our placement within our galaxy is important, because if you're too close to the center of the galaxy, that's the center of the galaxy is extremely active. You just picture yourself being in downtown New York City, or maybe in the middle of Beijing or LA or London, something like, you know, you're in a super densely populated area. There's cars driving everywhere, people going, there's lots of buildings, lots of things, you know, maybe construction, maybe it's, you know, they're building things, you know, ripping up the roads. There's a whole lot of things happening there. You can't just pick a random spot in downtown, you know, where near where I am at, Cleveland. You can't just pick a spot in downtown Cleveland just to, you know, lay down and or build a house. You know, it's got to be a safe spot, right? It's got to be a place away from traffic, right? And there's a whole lot less of that space there that's safe. And in a similar way, the center of our galaxy is very busy. It's very dangerous. Supernovas, you know, suns exploding, reaching the end of their life cycle and exploding. Life cycle, rather. You have asteroids, a lot of different material getting thrown around, a lot of it far bigger than the Earth. So if you have an errant asteroid that gets too close to us, that can really jack up our gravitational pull, or our life here, because the gravitational pull of that asteroid, sorry to kind of get stumbling over my words there, but, you know, that can happen. That's assuming, a not, you know, it doesn't directly hit us. If it does directly hit us and it's bigger than us, obviously we're bye-bye. So that's a problem. If it's smaller, even a meteor the size of a house flying 20,000-30,000 miles an hour, even that would be absolutely devastating to huge areas of our planet. Just the size of a house. I live in a 2.5-story colonial, okay? My house is not all that big, you know? It's maybe, you know, 100 feet, or not even 100 feet. It's probably like 60 feet by 60 feet by, I don't know, 30 feet, 50 feet, something like that. It's not a very big home. And if that were to, if an asteroid that size were to hit us between like 20 and 30,000 miles an hour, which I believe is how fast things fly, I could be wrong, and it might be much faster. But the point is, if an asteroid of that size hit us, you're talking about continental impact. You know, it's like a nuclear bomb going off. I think much worse. So, you know, you want to be far enough away from that activity so that way you're safe. And likewise, you can't be too far away, because at one point in our history, in the Earth's history, if you go by scientific theory, and you believe that the Earth is billions of years old, If you go by that, then you can't be too far out, because then you're not close enough to receive some of that necessary material, right? There's a lot of heavy metals in that compose the Earth. And so scientific theory says that got here in part by being impacted in, you know, before we had much of an atmosphere, that it got impacted by, you know, these different asteroids and different comets and whatnot that deposited these materials in their amounts into our planet. And that's what makes us up. And again, before I get too much further on that, I just want to acknowledge that when I say some of these things, you might say, well, I don't believe that the Earth is billions of years old. I believe God made it in 6 days, just like the Bible says. Don't you know that, Jim? Come on. And while I acknowledge that is possible, I'm not saying that it's impossible or that it's possible. I'm not making a claim to say this is what I believe. I'm just explaining. I'm going into the scientists, the atheist territory, and I'm playing in their playground and explaining to them in their house why they're wrong, why God exists, why his name is Jesus, and that what he says is true. Okay, I'm going in their house. Okay, so that's why when you hear some of the things I say, and I would say that as a caveat to the rest of anything I say today and any future messages, that is the foundation of which I tend to try to evangelize. I go into someone else's house, use their rules, and show them how Jesus is real. So I don't want to trip anyone up here. My personal beliefs on the creation of Earth is I'm not sure, but I know God did it. Because when you look at Genesis, the genre of book that it is not, it's a creation myth genre. That's not supposed to imply that it's less reliable because I'm using the word myth. It's a genre, just like poem and historic, evidence and, apocalyptic evidence, like the Revelation, like communication is, like, which is the New Testament letters, like the Gospels, again, historical accounts, much of the Old Testament, historical accounts. You have law written in there. Again, poems. We have Proverbs. You know, there's lots of different genres created in the Bible. And so I think that because the genre of the first several chapters of Genesis and the way it was written in, I think that puts me in a position where I'm not sure whether it should be taken word for word or if the thing we're supposed to walk away with is God did it. So in this case, I know there's a lot of different theories of how to interpret the first few chapters of Genesis. I'm fans of them all. I like them. I'm intrigued by them. And we'll just say the jury's out as far as I'm concerned. And as I continue to think about it and come to a conclusion, but like I was mentioning earlier, I very much consider that to be an open-handed issue that we should be open as Christians within Christian discussion and debate. We should be open on that discussion as we wade through it. So again, I say that to say I don't necessarily believe that the Earth is billions of years old. But again, I'm going to the atheist home. And I'm saying God exists, his name is Jesus, and this is, and what he said is true, and this is how I'm explaining things to them is on their own turf. So placement of our solar system within our galaxy is important. Time period within our galaxy. There was a time when our galaxy was not as hospitable, okay? It is thought that several billion years ago, we had recently finished coalescing is the word I'm looking for, coming together with another galaxy. And in fact, there are astronomical observations. You can find these where we can observe two different galaxies colliding with each other currently. And in that sense, you know, you just think about maybe you've got two swimming pools. You got one filled with blue water, another filled with red water. And you throw them together into a larger swimming pool, you're not going to end up with blue and red water. You're going to end up with purple water, right? Because blue and red are going to mix and change color and make purple. So, and that's all to say, because these things are not staying separate and isolated and contained. You're mixing them. And same thing happens when two galaxies collide. You're mixing all of its contents. It's a very violent process to the point where I doubt that there would be anything that would survive that was life any living thing would likely not survive that process. You're talking about a very, very short time frame of these two massive galactic things coming together and then forming one new galaxy, which at that point could potentially be life permitting, but at least in the current state, during that collision, that is not a life permitting situation. Black holes are coming together, right? Stars are bumping into each other and trying to create this new equilibrium. So, and likewise, you don't want the galaxy to be too old, right? Maybe it's falling apart, cooling down, and things are just spreading out and dying. You don't want that either. That's a problem. So the time period within our galaxy matters. Time period within our solar system, right? The life cycle of our sun and the planets that surround it also matter, okay? And there's a book I'm going to reference later that explains that in a lot better way, in a more detailed way than I will, so I'm not going to spend too much time there. The shape of our galaxy, okay? It's interesting. There are several different types of shapes of galaxies out there, and not all of them are life-permitting. So that's interesting to note. We need a moon of an appropriate size orbiting Earth. And not a lot of people think about that so much, but the moon is a factor of our planet being life-permitting. The moon pulls our tides. It moves our tectonic plates. And without that, it's thought that in the earlier stages, the tectonic plate movement aspect, in the early stages of the Earth's development, that life would not have been able to be churned up and moved around and developed, because we wouldn't have had a moon. And likewise today, the tides are influenced by the moon. And it's all, again, thought that the movement of the tides is a necessary requirement for life to be moved around and shuffled together, and for life to grow and develop. So you need a moon, and it's got to be the right size. Can't be too small, can't be too big, right? Because then you would just collide with us. It wouldn't be in our orbit. It would just collide with us. We would gravitate together. That's a problem. The tilt of the Earth is a factor, okay? If the Earth right now is tilting at an axis, I think, of like 32 point something degrees. I might be wrong on that. I don't know. But if that was affected, that would be a problem. I think it was in 2005. Don't quote me on the year here, but I remember when I was a bit younger, there was a tsunami that struck the coast of southern India. And when that happened, it was caused by a tectonic plate shift out in the ocean. And what was happening is two tectonic plates had touched together. So if you can imagine, just flatten your hands and touch them together, okay? And then on one of your hands, just start buckling it up, bending your knuckles to the point, and keep your tips together, but buckle it up so that way you're forming kind of like a C, right? Or I should say an upside down U is the better way to put it. It's forming a C because they're caught together, and one's kind of it's still pushing forward, but it doesn't have anywhere to go, okay? Because it's smaller than the bigger one, right? And then all of a sudden, the bottom or the front part of that tectonic plate just flattens, and then you can imagine your two hands, your fingers being flat on top of each other. And that is essentially what happened. It was about 15, 16 years ago, I believe. I think it was 2005. And that tsunami that hit southern India, well, because of how it came about, that massive earthquake that caused the tsunami, because of how strong it was, when that tsunami hit the southern coast of India, it sped up the world's rotation by a millisecond, and it changed the tilt of our Earth by a fraction, a very microscopic fraction of a degree. And now, on one side, I'm kind of just fascinated that there's anything on Earth that could happen that could change, you know, the speed at which we rotate, or the tilt of our Earth. That's just fascinating to me. But the concern was, oh my gosh, you know, we've changed the speed of the rotation of the Earth. We've changed, the tilt of the Earth just a little bit. Is that going to affect us, right? How is that going to affect life on Earth? And it turned out that it was so small that it would be essentially unnoticeable, at least for now, is our thought about it. But the fear there is because the speed at which the Earth spins and the tilt that it's at are also likewise necessary for us to be life-permitting. If you change those, you completely kill everything on Earth. Earth is spinning about 1,000 miles an hour, okay? If you suddenly stopped the Earth from spinning, you would immediately experience winds of 1,000 miles an hour until everything settled. Imagine that. It's crazy. But that spin, the spin speed, the tilt, those are all necessary. You need presence of gas giants, gas giant planets, that act as shields around us. Jupiter and Saturn are essentially, especially Jupiter, are essentially vacuum cleaners in our solar system. And all the dangerous asteroids and comets and whatnot that still end up flying through toward us, its gravitational pull is so strong, it ends up pulling in most of those. And in fact, there was not long ago, we were able to look at Jupiter, and we were able to see some spots on its surface. And those spots were a place where there was, I think, 3 or 4 Earth-sized comets or asteroids that hit it. And you could see as it punctured through the gas. And it's just insane to think about, what would have happened if Jupiter wasn't there and maybe it flew our way. 3 or 4 Earth-sized asteroids or comets. That would be very scary. And they don't even need to hit us. Something that size just needs to come close to us to kill everything here. At that point, you're talking about a body that big. If it came maybe close enough to touch the moon, or maybe it knocked the moon away, right? You're talking something like that. You're talking about an event that's going to radically shift the ability of life to exist here on Earth. So you need that. And likewise, on a smaller scale, our asteroid belt actually serves the same function. On a smaller scale, those home-sized asteroids that I mentioned earlier constantly get sucked up and knocked together and find their home in our asteroid belt, not here on Earth, because we've got a secondary shield in the asteroid belt. We need proper atmospheric pressure and temperature to allow for liquid water, and which is a necessary aspect for life on Earth. The natural elements in appropriate quantities to allow for development of advanced technology is also something that we need. See, when you talk about that, you're not necessarily talking about a life permitting factor at this point, but you are talking about something that allows for intelligent life to grow and develop, advanced technologies that we use. Think of it this way. Gold is a great example. Gold is a substance that we have in a pretty decent quantity on this planet, right? And it's not just used for wedding rings and necklaces and jewelry and whatnot. Gold is inside your smartphone. If you're listening to me today, whether it's on a computer or on a smartphone, you have gold inside those devices. Now, don't go ahead and take it apart and scrap it for your gold. The device you have is far more valuable with the gold in it than if you take it out. You're going to lose money on that proposition. So please leave your smartphone, leave your computer alone. It needs that gold. But it's an amazing conductor of electricity because it's very soft and it's very malleable. And so you're able to form it into some very specific shapes so that way electricity can go from one place to another. We need gold to be able to develop advanced technology. Gold is used all the time in our space missions and programs. So you take things like that, and then you take out other elements that allow us to build really heavy things, structures that allow us to support large amounts of weight, like skyscrapers go to a sports stadium, right? Go to a baseball stadium or a football stadium and just take a look down and around and notice how much concrete that you have below you, and that there's people below your concrete, right? Or that if your concrete were to suddenly give and crumble, how far you would fall. There's some people that are many stories and stories in the air, sitting on a concrete bench or a seat that's secured to a concrete bench or concrete stair or platform. If concrete wasn't that strong, we would not be able to build large structures like that. We would be essentially doomed to smaller several story structures, and that's about it. Whatever we think that we could build with, maybe with stone, for example, that we could refine. So those things are a factor as well. And we're going to get into universal constants here in a moment when we get to the most macro level. But there's a whole lot of other factors at this galactic, I know that's a term that gets kind of thrown around in like science fiction circles, but it's real. Galactic level, at the solar system level, and at the planetary level, there's a whole lot of factors that make our planet life permitting. And you need that. And for all of these things to come together, you're talking about, you know, imagine this. It wouldn't be a stretch to say that if for us to have a life-permitting planet, galaxy, solar system, for us to have those things life-permitting, it would kind of be like if you were to point a gun at a target placed on the moon while you're blindfolded and in the dark, and maybe dizzy, right? So somebody spun you around like they did when you're getting ready to do a pinata, right? And they spin you around, they got you blindfolded, you're in the dark, you're pointing a gun up at the moon, hopefully, and you're going to have to try to shoot that target and get a bullseye. That's kind of like the odds are for us being able to get a life-permitting galaxy, solar system, planet, okay? It sounds to me like our atheist or naturalist friend needs another miracle, but that they don't believe in, by the way. So, you know, we're at two so far, two miracles, three actually, because you had to violate the law of motion, you had to violate the notion that things do not just pop out of nothing, uncaused, right? And also you need these astronomical odds, from a planetary solar system and galactic standpoint to be answered. But I will say this, I'll acknowledge this, that in scientific circles, there is some debate on how many of these factors are legitimate, legitimately controlling or impacting the viability of life. There's not a whole lot of disagreement on them. More disagreement maybe on how much they affect or how forgiving or unforgiving they are. But if you set all of these aside, right, and my little colorful example of how hard it would be for these things to just come about by chance, right, by shooting a target on the moon. If you just look at the cosmological constants, speed of light, gravity, strong and weak nuclear force, things like that. If you look at the cosmological constants, and we've been able to assess them and see it, you know, at what point, you know, what they are, you know, we're able to measure them. And if you change those by even a very little bit, like the gravity, right, force of gravity, if you were to change how strong gravity is, just by a very, very, very small fractional amount, you suddenly don't have a life-permitting universe. Okay, we're not talking about a galactic standpoint, we're not talking about your solar system or the Earth, we're just talking about the universe, for space, time, and matter to exist. If you change the constant of gravity, or the speed of light, just by a very, very small amount, then you suddenly don't have a life-permitting universe. And this is something that atheistic scientists will admit, that they'll say that the universe has the appearance of fine-tuning. The appearance of fine-tuning, but they won't admit that it's actually fine-tuned by a creator, frustratingly. But if you were to just calculate the odds of our cosmological constants being what they are, and you run those numbers, and again, these numbers are brought by an atheistic scientist, somebody who doesn't believe in God, or at least is not a Christian, okay? And you include my next colorful example. The odds of getting all of our cosmological constants to coincide or to come in line so that way they're life permitting are like if you were to sit down with a friend and play some hands of five card poker, and your friend beating you 28 hands in a row with royal flushes every single time with the same suit, right? Your friend beats you with a royal flush of spades and then another royal flush of spades, and then another, same suit, same hand, every single time. And he does this 5, 6, 7 times in a row. 28 times in a row. That's the odds that all of our cosmological constants would be attuned to the number, to the point that they're at. That's the odds of it. It's mind-boggling. And I would say to you, maybe you're an unbeliever and you're listening to this. If you were to sit across the table from a friend playing a hand of poker and they beat you with a royal flush, you would probably both laugh and just be amazed at how insanely lucky they were to have a royal flush once, right? And then they do it again and again. How many royal flushes with the same suit are you going to allow your friend to have before you turn around and say, you're manipulating the cards? Let me suggest to you that somebody is manipulating the cosmological cards here. It's not possible for these things to happen without God being involved, okay? I'm going to make a few more statements before we wrap things up, so we'll start to kind of pick up pace here. First, a word of caution, because, you know, you think, okay, I'm talking a lot about science, and there's a lot of scientists that might disagree with, you know, my inferences, right? The conclusions I'm coming to. The facts that I'm using are the facts. These are the facts that scientists agree on. But my inferences, what are my conclusions? They don't come to my conclusions, so why should anyone believe me? Well, I would point out that just because a scientist makes a statement doesn't mean that statement is scientific or that it was derived or constructed in adherence to scientific law, right? So a scientist can say that Christianity is false, as an example, right? But that statement has zero scientific weight or value. And that scientist, you know, let's call him Joe, Joe the scientist. Later we find out that Joe was bullied by a person who said they were a Christian. So he has lived his life, hating Christians because he was bullied by them, leading up to him eventually becoming a scientist as an adult, and then making the statement Christianity is false, right? So, but because he's a scientist, oh, wow, me as a Christian, I should be nervous, that I should be intimidated by that because, you know, a scientist says that Christianity is false, and, you know, science I know is kind of reliable, so if science says it's false, then it's false. Well, no, that scientist has said this, and he's not used any scientific evidence or reasoning to come to that conclusion. He doesn't like Christianity, he doesn't like Christians. He's been, you know, a friend of mine says that, you know, there's two reasons that a lot of people either become a Christian or don't become a Christian, and one of them is because they know a Christian. Is one of the reasons why people, one of the biggest reasons why people come to Christ, and one of the reasons why people refuse Christ is because they know a Christian, right? Well, this person knew a bad example of a Christian, right? And we go back to that. You know, let's look at bad examples of Christians. You know, you can be a Christian and be a bad example of a Christian and Christ still be true. Christ still be God. You know, you think about this for a second. Let's go to basketball. Okay, we all like basketball. Huge debate, right? Who's the better player, Michael Jordan or LeBron James? I say it doesn't matter. They're both excellent professional players. They will go down as the two greatest players, most likely, that the game has ever seen, until maybe a new LeBron James or Jordan comes along. And of course, yes, there's others out there, say Larry Bird, and there's another guy I think gets tossed around, but point is these guys are excellent examples of basketball players, right? Whether you think one is better than the other, it doesn't matter. These guys are excellent examples of basketball players. Excellent. Top notch. Okay? If I say that I'm a professional basketball player, okay, and I get up there and I can't hit a three, or I can't do a layup, or I can't steal a ball or pass a ball, you know, that, or hold on to one, right? Somebody tries to take it from me. I'm butterfingers. You know, I'm not being a very good example of professional basketball, right? But that doesn't mean that professional basketball is not real or that it's false or that it's inherently now less than because me. I'm just a bad example of a basketball player, okay? And this guy, this scientist, Joe Schmo over here, the scientist who had a bad experience with a bad example of a Christian, well, that's now led him to the belief that God isn't real and that his name isn't Jesus, right? So, but that doesn't affect the truth, he's had a bad experience with a bad example. So, and I'm sure a lot of us have had experiences. That's one of my things. My story, coming to Christ, my testimony includes bad examples of Christians around me. And it wasn't until I realized that those bad examples of Christians didn't matter. God is still God. He's still real. His name is Jesus, and what he said is true. Another interesting point. There is no science or research that explains emotion. There's no science or research that explains consciousness. We can't understand. We don't get that. To this day, we do not understand why conception happens. We can describe the process and make observations along the way, okay? But we can't explain or predict the outcome of the conception and subsequent growth process of any life form, human or otherwise, right? As simple as a process this is, as ordinary as it is, as often as it occurs, if you take Sally and Jim, not me, different Jim, you take Sally and, we'll change the name, Sally and Brian, put them together, they get married, they do the deed, they have kids. You can't look at their genetic makeup and then determine what their kids are going to turn out like. You're not going to be able to tell them how tall they are, or what color their skin's going to be, or what color hair they're going to have, color eyes. You can make some inferences based on genetics. Well, it's not going to be this because they don't have the genetic markers. Or maybe you can say they will have brown eyes because they both have dominant recessive brown eye genes. You can't get anything outside of that, you know, based on the genetic makeup. But you can't tell all of these things every single time based on the genetic makeup of a parent one and two. Another interesting point. The universe is understandable, observable, and the laws of nature and science and physics can be tested and verified. And while that might seem a strange claim to make, it's not at all guaranteed by a universe born of chaos and randomness, but is absolutely expected of a universe created and designed for the purpose of being known, studied, and understood by humankind. Everything that exists in space-time, and has matter must have a cause. The universe exists in space, time, and has matter, therefore it must have a cause. And I would submit to you that the God of the Bible is that cause. And as I say this, I can imagine someone saying, well, then who or what created God, right? If everything that exists has a cause, then who created God? And I would say that I would try to back you up and say, well, you're dealing with a bad assumption here. Because again, you have to go back to the beginning of this premise. It's called the Kalam cosmological argument. It's actually a legitimate philosophical statement, argument, born of logic. Okay, it's everything that exists in space, time, and has matter must have a cause. Well, the God of the Bible does not, he's timeless, okay? Exists out of time. He is not matter. He is not physical. He is spirit. Okay. So you're talking about these things. He is an unembodied mind. He does not exist like you and I. He did not have a beginning. He always existed. So when you ask the question, well, who created God? If God created anything, then who created God? You're actually not understanding properly what the Christian belief system is and how we would define God. Okay. So we would define God as uncreated. He always existed. He is timeless. He exists outside of time. He didn't have a beginning. He doesn't have an end. He's not getting older or any smarter. He is all powerful. Yeah. So that's a difference between the God that Christianity believes in versus maybe other religions. Other religions may have gods that were created, like the Greek and Roman pantheons, right? Their gods were born, okay, all of them. And they have predecessors. So I don't know enough about the Greek and Roman pantheon to know how their predecessors got there, or if they believe in just an eternally old universe, that the universe is timeless. That's not the universe that we live in. The universe we live in had a beginning. So I'm going to take a pause here just a moment, because I'm hitting up against my time limit here for this recording. So I'm going to take a break, and I'm going to come right back, and we're going to finish up the last few points I want to make. And then go over a few other details. So be right back. Okay, everyone, we are back. I'm just going to make a few more points. So I kind of ended on a philosophical slash scientific note, right? We're talking about scientific matters, but dealing with a logic problem, right? When I talked about how, anything that begins to exist has got to have a cause, right? And that cause is God, and specifically the God of the Bible. And maybe to make another philosophical point that I'll touch on more next time, is it's very important, because when people object to God, okay, they say, one of the biggest objections, what was mine too as a kid, when I first rejected God and stopped believing in him and became an atheist, the basis upon which that I made that decision was, God, why do you let bad things happen? Okay, we can all look around and we see evil, immoral things happening all the time. Doesn't matter how you define evil or immoral things. You can look around and you see just bad, non-ideal things happening every day. You know, turn on the news, you'll get loaded with it, all right? And so somebody might argue, well, because of that, God can't exist. And what I would say to you to that is that you need to take a step back. So I understand your criticisms of the evil that's in the world. It's a fair criticism to make. Like I said, same one I had when I was a kid, which eventually led to me not believing in God anymore. And so I don't blame anybody for following that line of thinking and coming to that conclusion, because I did so myself. But when I thought about this a little bit more, I had to kind of reassess my conclusion here, because if I'm an atheist, which I used to be, right? So I know what it's like to think this way. If I'm an atheist and I believe that we all just got here from random product of chance, plus time, plus matter, we're just a bunch of random different molecules that coalesced and, you know, came to being, and now somehow we're sentient, right? We have consciousness. If I believe that as an atheist, then there's nothing inherently good or bad about anything. It's just a different, you know, the TV that's sitting in front of me is a random collection of molecules just arranged in a way that brings me pleasure when I get ready to sit down and watch a movie or a TV show with my wife or play video games or something like that. You know, it's just a different collection of molecules. The desk that I'm sitting at is a different collection of molecules from that TV, which is a different set of collection of molecules than the phone that I'm recording this on, from my Bible, from me, from a cockroach, from an ant, to the cat, to a bird, from a whale, to a fish, to an amoeba, to a jellyfish. They're all just different, randomly collected pieces of molecules forming different objects or living things. Okay, and that's what evolution teaches, right? That out of it, non-living material, again, another problematic thing, we've never observed non-life go to life, so that's scientifically problematic. But from that perspective, if you look at that, we are a randomly collected piece of or group of molecules, me and you and the computer and the phone, the books, the door, the floor, the chair you're sitting in. It's all just a random collection of molecules. There's nothing moral or immoral about any of these things. Nothing special about them. You know, they're just molecules arranged in a different way. And so for one set of molecules to impose itself on another is not a moral, immoral thing. It's just one molecule doing what it likes or thinks is best. Against another one, whether it's good or bad. You know, on that worldview, rape is not wrong. It's just unfortunate for the victim. Murder isn't wrong. It's just generally not productive. Stealing or lying aren't really that bad so long as you can justify it with something. So these things are not objectively wrong. Now, I don't believe for one second that the majority of people, that they believe that objective morality doesn't exist. I believe, you know, just think about, you know, whether you're an atheist or not, or if you know an atheist, and you ask them, hey, do you think murder's wrong? Oh, yeah, it's terrible. You think rape is wrong? Oh, yeah, it's terrible. No one here is saying that the atheist or the Christian have a different set of morals when it comes to these questions, right? We all agree that these things are wrong inherently, that they're never right. But for the atheist to believe that, it's in contradiction to their worldview, because we're all just a different collection of molecules. And if I can do something that brings me pleasure or brings me some kind of benefit, then more power to me, I should do it on that worldview. And there's a lot of atheists. I shouldn't say a lot. I don't know the numbers. But I know there's plenty of atheists who just think, okay, well, if I can get some kind of benefit, then I'll do that. Because that's all life is. We're born, we live, we die. And somewhere in between there, we want to try to have as much fun and live the best life that we can. That is essentially the way that the atheist is going to be forced to live. Because that's the world that they live in. Maybe they have some kind of altruistic notions about doing good for the earth that we live in. Yeah, sure, that makes sense. But it's not at all required. Really, the only thing required of you at that point is, again, just to try to make your life as good as you can. And that can be kind of a dangerous place to do that. And if you think I'm just being facetious, or if I'm just, putting up a straw man on the atheist worldview, go look up people like Stephen Fry and Richard Dawkins who believe exactly what I'm saying. They have followed their worldview to its natural conclusion, is that there is no such thing as objective morality. Stephen Fry, he's a well-known actor, and he's very well educated and whatnot, and he'll say that the Catholic sex abuse scandal of the 60s wasn't really that bad then, but it is now. Well, no, it was bad then, and it's bad now. Equally bad then, equally bad now. It never should have happened, and that's a stain on the Catholic Church for a while. It's going to be there for a long, long time. Richard Dawkins has said in debates and in public discussions that that murder isn't wrong, he just does not prefer it, which is the logical conclusion to where his worldview ends him. So if you're going to be an atheist, and I'm not trying to do this to insult or disparage an atheist, or a naturalist, somebody who just believes in what you can see and observe around you, I'm not trying to do that. I'm just letting you know. And if you don't believe me, that's fine. Go look into it. That's where your worldview will naturally lead you to. So just keep that in mind. Some historical evidence for the life of Jesus. Because each one of these messages, to catch up with you, so I did science and now I'm kind of shifting to philosophy and now again to history. Again, when I shared this in Oberlin, it is I was doing one a week for 3 weeks. And I created these so that way they had a bent to them. Each time I would go up there with a specific focus, science or philosophy or history. I didn't at all anticipate that somebody was going to be there each time. So I didn't anticipate that I had the opportunity to build on my messages, right? Just that I would be able to catch somebody. And if you had a science bent to you, hopefully I'm catching you on the science day. But if you didn't come on science day, you're still going to hear scientific evidence, right? So we did science, that's the majority part of this. I'm going to give you some philosophical reasons, I already did that. Now we're going to do historical evidence for Jesus. My opinion is one of the most powerful arguments for the truth claims of the Gospels. And you might be interested to know that the existence of Jesus, the person of Jesus, is one of the most agreed upon facts of ancient history. Historians agree unanimously that a man named Jesus existed 2,000 years ago in the geographical area of Israel, was put to death by the Roman government via crucifixion, and soon after had a massive following, claiming that he had risen from the dead. And this group of followers would, despite massive persecution, eventually gain enough influence to become the world's dominant religion in a few short centuries, and remain that way ever since. Now, these are what historians, non-Christian historians, will acknowledge. Jesus really existed. He really did exist 2,000 years ago. He lived, he died, Christians believe, he rose from the dead and ascended into heaven. That's the part that historians won't necessarily agree on, because that would essentially require belief in Christ. Okay, and so we're talking about a spiritual thing there. But they agree on the other points, and that people said that he rose from the dead and said that he ascended into heaven. And then what they will observe after that is that suddenly this thing called Christianity just exploded out of the gates. And despite, murders and torture and all sorts of pressure to not be a Christian, the church grew incredibly fast and within a few hundred years transformed the world. So it's very interesting. And the last thing that I'll say here is that when you look at Jesus, Jesus so accurately describes the human condition, and in himself actually provides the answer. Jesus said that I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So if you're listening to this, think about this. Know this. Jesus today, right now, he offers you the standing invitation to walk with him, to be forgiven, accepted, and loved. And it's my sincere hope that you will choose to accept his invitation as I did almost 10 years ago. Because he's worth it. Been a Christian for almost 10 years. And not one day have I regretted. Not one day have I regretted becoming a Christian. Now, I've said a lot of things. And I have a few book recommendations for you. Okay. So, first one I'll talk about is Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis used to be an atheist, and he was a very prominent one. He had a radio station, used to argue against the Christian world and life view, and eventually became a Christian and became one of its strongest defenders. You may know him from the Narnia books. He wrote the books that eventually got turned into the movies that we've been able to enjoy today. William Lane Craig is somebody that I really admire. He's a Christian debater, philosopher, science fanatic, and he has been on the debate scene for decades. Somebody who I would consider to be scary smart. This guy just knows his stuff inside and out, and I've not met many people that can rival him on a debate stage. And regardless, I've not really heard many people that can really defeat him outside of just rivaling him. So very, very interesting. He wrote a book called Reasonable Faith. It's just a book full of apologetics and Christian truth. So I would definitely recommend that. There's another book called Darwin's Doubt by Stephen Meyer. Stephen Meyer is someone who's a believer in intelligent design. So I mentioned that earlier, how fine-tuned our universe and our planet is for it to be life-permitting. Well, Stephen Meyer looks at a lot of the evidence surrounding evolution. While he'll make a lot of claims, he's got a pretty big book, he'll make a lot of claims, the thing that you'll end up walking away with is that evolution cannot be true without God being directly involved. So I don't believe that evolution proper is a good enough explanation for how life got here. And I think that his book, Darwin's Doubt, again, Stephen C. Meyer, I think the book that he wrote does a really good job of highlighting that. Another one, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. It's written by Josh McDowell and Sean McDowell, who's a PhD. Guys that are incredibly smart. Another very big book. But it's just chock full, much like Reasonable Faith, chock full of lots of great arguments for why you should be a Christian, for the truth claims of the Gospels and of the Bible. Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, written by Nabil Qureshi. This guy was a Muslim, as the title indicates. He was seeking to deepen his faith in Allah, right, in the Islam tradition, and ends up through what the Quran teaches about Jesus, ends up being inspired to look into Jesus more, and then finds himself believing in Jesus as Lord. So it's a very interesting story. Another one, Is God a Moral Monster? Written by Paul Copan. There's a lot of things in the Old Testament that sound on the surface or look like very immoral things. Some things that God is directly stating, you should do this. Not many, but there's some. And they just seem really bad, evil, immoral. Like, God, how could you do that? If you're a loving God, why would you do that? And Paul Copan goes to the Old Testament. That's usually where we get the most objections to the Bible's morality. Goes to the Old Testament, and he breaks down a lot of these situations and helps to explain in historical context what some of these things meant with critical contextual analysis, looking at the scripture and what it says, and then eventually will help to understand, either by careful reading or historical context, explain why these things aren't really saying what they are or what that really meant in that time, or just, like I said, a simple reading of the actual verse in context can usually explain a lot of the problems. improbable planet. A lot of the stuff that I explained from you from a cosmological, from a galactic solar system and planetary perspective as what allows our world and universe to be life permitting, I got from this book. It's called, again, Improbable Planet by Hugh Ross. He is a scientist, I believe an astrophysicist. And so he does a really great job of analyzing the timeline of things. And again, like me, he stepped into the atheist backyard and said, hey, I've got an argument for you. And he explains things on their terms, why you need to be able to, why you should believe in God because of the scientific evidence. A very compelling book. I really enjoyed it. The Case for Christ, another one I've really enjoyed reading, by Lee Strobel. He's written a series of books, which are all good. Case for Christ is just a great example of this guy, Lee Strobel. He was a writer, an investigative journalist for the Chicago Tribune, and an atheist. And he just lived a very immoral, debauched life, and this is his words, how he would describe it. One day his wife comes home saying she's a Christian. And so he set out on what he expected to be a weekend journey to disprove Christianity through his incredible investigative reporting skills, and ends up after about a year and a half, almost 2 years, investigating himself right into Christianity, finding out that the truth claims of the Bible are exactly what they are, that they are true, and that people should believe in Jesus. And the last one that I'll recommend to you is a book called Cold Case Christianity by J. Warner Wallace. J. Warner Wallace is a cold case homicide detective in L.A. County, or was. He may have retired at this point, I'm not sure. His job was to look at murder cases that were old, cold case, right? These cases, they couldn't be determined as who murdered this person. And then he turns around, picks up the case, looks at the evidence, and then turns around and attempts to identify the murderer. And these cases are very difficult to solve because in many cases, all, if not most, of the people who were involved or witnessed the crime are dead, right? It's cold case. Cold case means that they tried to solve it, they couldn't, and they put it in the shelf in hopes that they can try to solve it eventually. This guy's job is to look at old evidence and determine today what happened. And what ended up happening with him is there was a guy in the force that, I think if I remember his testimony well enough, there's a guy in the force that he knew and just like, hey, you gotta come to church. And this guy's an atheist, right? Gotta come to church, gotta do this, come on. You should believe in Jesus. And the guy eventually is like, look, would you just read the Gospels? Can you do that? Can you just read the Gospels and then get back to me? And, he was like, okay, fine, I'll do that. And so when he reads the Gospels, again, as a cold case detective, he reads these Gospels like somebody would old eyewitness testimony. And so from that perspective, he looks into this and then does a little bit more research and a little more research and finds himself believing in Christ because of the truth claims of the Gospels. So these are great books. I definitely recommend them to you, and they'll encourage you. They might serve as great conversation starters or great ways to evangelize to somebody or lead somebody else to Christ if they're open to reading a book on it. So I encourage you guys to get them, read them, and then if you feel led to turning around and offering them up to other people. So with that being said, that is going to conclude today's episode. Hope you enjoyed Scientific Evidence for God. Next episode that I'll be coming up to, might wait about a week or so for posting it. The next episode we'll do is going to be on the philosophical, arguments and evidence for God, philosophical arguments for the necessity of God. And I think you're really going to enjoy that. So thank you guys so much. I hope you guys have a great day, that you're blessed by this. Go ahead and refer it to somebody. Share this with somebody that you think that they might be blessed by, and encourage them to believe in Jesus. Thank you, and God bless.